All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, February 16th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a cloudy and damp with fog and mist, 37 degrees. And we were in the almost near 60 yesterday, so everything is melting right now here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Wednesday? We titled the show IoT is an Internet of Things, Neuromorphic AI, DNA, Blockchain, and 3D Cell Printing. And I had kind of gotten on this path looking at some of the 3D printing techniques that are going on. We found out there was a brand new startup that wants to connect thousands of 3D printers on the blockchain across a potentially global network. And then we heard Georgie Porgy Church talk about some new company he started, and I don't remember the name of it, where you could offer up your DNA sequence to his blockchain and then utilize that to sell it back to pharmaceutical companies who could use it for testing and to create drugs. We also found out that they are getting pretty far ahead with 3D printing stem cells, you know, with these full 3D scans of body parts, and they are able to do high resolution CAT scans and MRIs. And I just saw, and I did not put that in my list here, but if you hold on just one second, if I can scroll fast enough, we can get there. Hold on. Here it is. CRISPR camera. This caught me. Camera records cell action with new CRISPR tricks. Biologists have long devised ways to track the inner workings of cells. And why would that be? Well, that would be because they want to mimic nature and reverse engineer it to create their own machines. We found out yesterday that not only had Georgie Porgy Church stored a book, an entire book, in DNA, but DARPA has now been working on trying to create a search engine out of DNA, and they also awarded $32 million to MIT and the Broad Institute for DNA design and manufacturing. Now, they are using DNA is a storage medium already in the laboratory. They said that it could store data for up to a million years if they encased it in glass. Guys, we are going to become a biological computer to them. And I mean, I don't know, this was kind of not really a joke, but kind of an out there postulation at one point in time. But I'm telling you, some of the stuff that I'm seeing, you know, as the robots are going to take all the jobs and we will not be earning our keep anymore, there is no free lunch. I told you Mr. Feinauer taught us that in fifth grade. There is no free lunch. You're not going to sit around and get your federal paycheck every week for not working for nothing. So we are going to become the guinea pigs in all of this. They're going to crack all the biological code, reverse engineer us, find spare parts, figure out how to live forever. That'll be too expensive for you and me because we'll be living on a pauper's salary. And of course, because of all the damage done to our DNA through upper genetics and environmental stresses or stress itself, the alcohol you drank at 14, we've caused genetic damage that others of us in our society may not have if they were more affluent in their family life. So anyway, let's get back here. Camera records cell action with its new CRISPR tricks. Biologists have long devised ways to track the inner workings of cells, tagging genes with fluorescent proteins. And this is some of that barcoding project that Georgie Porgy Church was working on and the like, to better understand diseases, embryology, and environmental impacts. And with the advent of CRISPR, best known as a genome editing tool, many groups have tried to fashion novel recording devices. In a proof-of-concept study published this week of Science, Harvard University's David Liu and Wexen Tang exploited the components of CRISPR to create two new recording systems that they call a CRISPR-mediated analog multi-event recording apparatus, or camera for short. One camera system records with the help of plasmids, which are circular pieces of DNA that float around bacterial cell cytoplasms. In this scheme, CRISPR kicks into action in response to a stimulus like light, an antibiotic, or a virus, directing the destruction of one or two nearly identical recorder plasmids. A tilt in the ratio of recorder 1 to recorder 2 captures the exposure to the stimulus, even offering details about the duration and the intensity of the exposure. The second camera, which works in mammalian cells as well, uses CRISPR variants called base editors to alter the DNA in a safe harbor gene that can then change its sequence without harming the cell. They show how these changes in the safe harbor gene sequences can record signals from the cellular process that then stimulus triggers, such as turning on a cancer-causing biochemical pathway. Or what about turning it off? So check that out. They can now record things that are going on inside of cells, guys. And as they start back-ending this stuff to neuromorphic artificial intelligence, we're going to look at some of that coming up here. Brain-like intelligence at the edge of the Internet of Things. But one of the things that struck me as I've been looking into this quite a bit over the years is really how much like a computer, a circuit. I mean, we're finding that there's all kinds of on and off gateways in the body within the cells that they can use different chemicals such as calcium to turn gateways on and off, zeros and ones, making us literally biological computer networks, which is insane, but I really think it's true. And the scary part is, as they start cracking these codes, and we're going to start looking at some of that also, nothing is going to be safe. So this is a story I came across yesterday morning, and it was kind of from a higher level approach, but it kind of illustrates how basic it is that we are biological computers. So this is titled OOP, and that is, now I don't remember what the OOP was. It was for something about programming interfaces as an organic approach to computing. I am now reading, and that is the author named, his name isn't available easily, Graham, no last name. Graham is reading How Not to Network a Nation, which talks a lot about cybernetics. Not merely cybernetics as a theory of control in complex systems. Cybernetics shares a root with governor, which is fans of the entomological fallacy, but cybernetics is the intersectional discipline matching organizational and management theory with computer science, anthropology, and biology. It puts all those together. A study of systems and animals, people and machinery, and their self or externally directed control. Now that's what this whole technocracy is all about, is to be able to look at our complex societal systems, including our biological systems and our history and how things work and how we build hierarchies in our structure and then how to manipulate those to gain control. And there's a lot of different organizational groups that are going on, not just between individuals in a society, but also biologically between the cells. They are all complex systems, just like a computer network. We still use a lot of ideas from even early cybernetics thought right now, such as Claude Shannon's theory on entropy and information, as well as J.C.R. Licklider's ARPANET, and von Neumann's computer architecture for artificial neural networks. And even though the proponents aren't often associated with the field, I think it is reasonable to argue that object-oriented programming, and that is what OOP stood for, is a cybernetically driven system approach. A lot of cybernetics theory is about the components of a system and the messages that those components can pass between each other to achieve the control and the feedback. And in an object-oriented programming sense, Alan Kay was seeking a model to a software system as a network of messages flowing between independent computer program components. And he made an analogy with living organisms clear. He said, I thought of objects in the programming as being like biological cells or individual computers on a network only able to communicate with messages. So messaging came at the very beginning, and it took a while to see how to do messaging in a programming language efficient enough to be useful. More advanced object-oriented systems such as Erlang's Even Display Autoposes automatically spawn new quote-unquote cells when old ones were damaged. They were able to do that in software programming. There are plenty of the intersectional natures of cybernetics that still has to inform me about my work, but informational theory helps me to understand the utility of a machine learning algorithm. Game theory and biological cooperation and cheating models also help describe how cryptocurrency is resilient against Byzantine general attacks, and now I understand that the biological systems analogy should help me with my software analysis and design. Now, guys, it's frightening, and I know there was a lot of techno-mumbo-jumbo, but it's frightening that people are actually seeing these connections between programming, not only in a digital sense, but in a biological sense. And that's why there are a lot of neurologists that are getting into artificial intelligence, and we have seen that a lot lately. Well, here's a story out of brainfacts.org. This was titled, and that caught my attention, is from February 13th, 2018. The tools that let neuroscientists study and even repair brain circuits. Neurons may be the building blocks of the brain, and remember, we can now make artificial ones, but no neuron works alone. Instead, neurons connect up with each other like wires into neural circuits and work together to accomplish certain tasks. And depending on how complex the task is, some circuits contain only a few neurons, while others contain millions. All neural circuits receive information, process and interpret it, and then send it out updated in signals for the brain to use in response. And this is very much like some of what is going on now in the build-out of the 5G network and putting intelligence out at the edge with some of these Internet of Things devices. I'm telling you, as we're doing some of these articles and we're getting in deep and trying to figure out a spin on how to write these stories and make this technology into another puzzle piece that fits into the whole picture, you really start thinking deep about how these things work, and you start seeing these parallels, like I'm saying right now, not only in the digital world, but moving to the biological and how they're going to interface all of this stuff together. For example, neural circuits in the eye convert light into information that the brain can understand, and also with optogenetics we looked at, which was another story we did, how they can use flashes of light to flip genetic switches in the brain, turn things on and off. Specialized cells called rods and cones detect the light and transmit the signals to the neurons in the retina. And these neurons collaborate to make sense of those signals and then relay that information about contrast, color, and motion to the visual centers of the brain. Sometimes, though, neural circuits malfunction. Injury and disease can damage neurons, disrupting neural circuits, just like a tree falling on an electrical wire. Neural circuits can also go haywire if individual neurons become overactive or non-active enough. Autism, epilepsy, and depression all result from problems in neural circuits, so they're going to have to fix us. Don't worry about that. With support from programs like YesO, our favorite Love to Hate the Brain Initiative, neuroscientists are inching closer to understanding how neurocircuits work and what can be done to fix your malfunctioning circuit. Functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRIs, let scientists take pictures of the brain to watch how human neural circuits work in real time. We've read a little bit about that, as well as transcranial magnetic stimulation, which allows doctors to stimulate neural circuits in psychiatric patients to alleviate their symptoms. Advances in genetic engineering have led to technologies that enable scientists to control neural circuits using light, ding, 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 optogenetics. And the brain harbors many mysteries still, but we are better armed to solve them than ever before. So let's take a closer look at the technologies that are spurring these advances. So the first one would be fMRI. It uses a magnetic field to measure changes in blood flow in the brain. And if the brain area is working hard to accomplish a certain behavior, it consumes a lot more oxygenated blood, producing a dip in the fMRI signal. And the simultaneous activation of multiple brain regions suggests that the areas are talking to each other in a neural circuit. fMRIs have revealed circuits underlying behaviors like reading or improvising in jazz musicians, as shown in the picture above. The fMRI is, of course, non-invasive, as it does not entail taking any drugs or undergoing any surgery, except for maybe that contrast dye that can screw up your kidneys. Through a National Institute of Health Brain Initiative Project grant, David Feinberg's research team at the Helen Willis Neuroscience Institute at the University of California, Berkeley, is pushing the boundaries of fMRI by designing the NextGen 7T. This is an ultra-high-resolution imaging machine. I told you this is what they're working on, ultra-high-res, and then they're going to feed it to the artificial intelligence. It'll capture some of the smallest regions of the brain, providing non-invasive pinpoint views, and this is going to be able to reverse engineer this stuff when they want to upload you to the cloud. The next one is PET, or the positron emission tomography. That creates an image of the brain by tracking radioactive molecules, injected radio tracers, which are molecules like glucose or dopamine with radioactive atoms tacked onto them, enter your bloodstream and circulate throughout the body, including your brain. A PET scanner can detect where these molecules end up in the brain. For example, a glucose or an oxygen radio tracer can identify which regions of the brain are most metabolically active, revealing regions connected via circuits. A dopamine radio tracer can reveal which brain circuits communicate via the neurotransmitter. Craig Levin's research at Stanford was awarded a Brain Initiative grant to usher in the next generation of PET imaging technologies completely dedicated to the brain, and the technology would heighten the sensitivity that PET has in tracking the marked molecules and blend the MRI-compatible interfaces. Next one, deep brain stimulation can reduce symptoms of damaged neural circuits like tremors arising from the death of motor control cells in Parkinson's. And for this device, it must be implanted in the brain, so it is only used on patients who have not benefited from less invasive treatments like classic drug-based therapies. It sends electricity into brain tissue, which then alters your activity. And although scientists fully don't understand how it works, we're still going to zippity-zap you. It is a reliable medical therapy that is particularly effective in treating Parkinson's. In collaboration of research efforts, neuroscientists in Maryland's Baltimore County are developing non-invasive technologies that will control neuron activity in targeted brain circuits to adjust behavioral output. Is that how they put it? And ultimately lead to therapies for brain illnesses. And then transcranial direct or alternate current stimulation, and this would be TDCS or TACS, involves sending small electrical currents, whether it be DC or AC, through the skull into the brain. These currents produce subtle changes in neural circuits, but it is unclear how useful the technique really is for treating disorders. Some companies, including the military, have explored these techniques to improve normal cognition, but the results have been mixed. Yeah, let's see if we can teach you how to fly an airplane by just zippity-zapping your brain. However, Javier Medina and researchers at Baylor College of Medicine are investigating the unknowns of this technique to bridge the knowledge gap and honing in on the cerebellum, which is the region of the brain known for its role in motor control. Scientists are measuring the impact of transcranial direct stimulation on neuron activity in different regions of the brain. Now, this next one sounds kind of scary, electroconvulsive therapy, and I wasn't really planning into getting into all of these. Then, of course, optogenetics with funding. They have been messing around with this at the Brain Research Institute at MIT. They are creating new tools that target specific neurons in wild animal models, specifically that have not been genetically modified. And that was one of the big things before. When we read about this, they had to genetically modify brain cells with opsins, which were these light-sensitive proteins that came out of algae. But these new tools that they have will be made available to the scientific community and will help scientists study circuits with greater precision without having to genetically modify the host. So where do we go from here? Well, there are lots and lots of rich big companies getting into the healthcare market. And that is what is frightening to me. We found out just recently, a couple weeks ago, that Jeff Bezos from Amazon, Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan, and Warren Buffett from Berkshire Hathaway have all decided that they are going to create their own healthcare company to be able to provide healthcare to their employees because of the dire situation with the single-payer system in the United States. Uh-oh, hold on. I had a video just start for me. Okay, I just killed it. All right, so we have a lot of big companies. We have Google, who is in the game with their Calico project to try to cure aging as a disease. And now we have places such as Amazon getting into healthcare. What we found out, Amazon is working with Bezos, Dimon, and Buffett. And they are pledging not only to create an employee healthcare system, but to stop soaring drug prices. And I mentioned this the other day, but I didn't have the story up. One of my greatest priorities, says Trump, and this was January 31st, 2018, is to bring down drug prices. Many other countries, these drug costs far less than what we pay in the United States. That's very, very unfair, and that is why I have directed my administration to make fixing the injustice of huge drug prices one of our top priorities. And I don't know whose side who was on. I'll just kind of toss this out there so you can start thinking about it. In the meantime, back in December of 2017, Amazon announces that it is in exploratory talks with generic drug makers. Amazon has talked to makers of generic drugs, including Mylan and Sandoz, about a potential entry into the pharmacy space. They may be about Amazon taking a role in drug purchasing, competing against distributors like McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, and Cardinal Health. Sources at Amazon say that the plans remain vague, but some are skeptical that the e-commerce giant might pull the trigger. That's pretty interesting. So now let's look at this. Digital Health Briefing, Business Insider, February 15th, yesterday, 2018. Amazon is building up its medical supply business. Fitbit acquisition expands the healthcare footprint. We're going to look at Fitbit as well. And scientists use nanobots, yes, of course, to treat cancer. And they've been talking about that for a while, but these are some pretty slick DNA nanobots. So Amazon is building up its medical supply business. Amazon is going to become your new provider. Amazon is expanding its business-to-business marketplace. And Amazon, they called it Amazon Business, to better serve U.S. hospitals and outpatient clinics with medical supplies, according to the Wall Street Journal. The e-commerce giant has reached out to hospital executives to discuss turning its marketplace from a business with limited selection of medical supplies to a major supplier of products, including more specialized items like hip implants. Are you kidding me? Why is this important? Well, Amazon's presence in the medical supply business could drive down costs and drive out some competitors as well. And hospital purchasing is typically structured around contracts between hospital systems, distributors, and manufacturers. This is something that, again, they could put on the blockchain. I've talked about Amazon having an Amazon Web Services section about blockchain as a service, and I see a lot of this coming. These transactions often come with additional costs, which can significantly increase the price of supplies, as well as fees and administration, marketing, and shipping costs. For 20 to 30% of the healthcare supply costs, according to an estimate, providing hospital systems with direct access to multiple manufacturers and an easy way to compare the prices will lead them to a more competitive pricing on medical supplies. And they also will have robots running the pick and pack facility in the warehouse. And this will all be done electronically through your Internet of Things devices that read your live real-time inventory on your shelving in your hospital back end and do your ordering automatically, bag tag and ship it on autonomous UPS vehicles, and then have your pick and delivery robots bring them inside and put them on a conveyor belt to be put away. I mean, I see how this all can work, guys. This is pretty frightening. This is taking humans out of the equation for every bit of this. And the way we're going to pay for it is to sell our biological data back to this industrial complex that'll be then developing new synthetic drugs to treat us based upon our DNA and our biological sequences. This does not only reduce the cost of supplies, but it'll also cut out other fees, such as those paid to the middlemen, ding ding blockchain, who facilitate the medical supply transactions. How will this impact the healthcare industry? Well, Amazon appears to be building out a full healthcare ecosystem, which would make it the biggest digital threat to the $3 trillion U.S. healthcare industry. And in the past year alone, the firm has introduced a HIPAA-compliant cloud feature, entering into a cloud partnership with health tech giant Cerner, launching a challenge to a third-party company to develop Alexa skills to help people with diabetes manage their conditions. And in January, it announced the creation of a healthcare company with JPMorgan Chase and Berkshire Hathaway. If Amazon continues this trajectory, it will become a one-stop shop for providers and patients. Yeah, how long is it going to be before your doctor is listed on Amazon and you could just purchase for $29.95 a consultation and read all of the five-star reviews that other patients had provided for him? I mean, this really could happen, guys. And then download your Amazon Healthcare AI app to connect to your Amazon Web Services doctor appointment. This is crazy. Wait, but make sure you upload your DNA sequence and photograph of yourself first. We found that out on Wednesday. I don't remember what that was for, but that was one of those DNA projects. So, all right, next story here. Fitbit acquisition expands its digital health footprint. Fitbit is acquiring a cloud-based healthcare platform called Twin Health to make its line of wearables more valuable to consumers and healthcare providers alike. Twin's HIPAA-compliant platform connects consumers diagnosed with chronic illnesses like diabetes and hypertension with doctors and coaches. The healthcare professionals can develop lifestyle strategies and programs that help the patients monitor and manage their illnesses. And the acquisition, which is expected to close in Q1 of 2018, is just the latest effort by Fitbit to build momentum in the healthcare industry as it looks to generate more revenue, millions, if not billions of dollars, of course, with the ubiquitous connectivity of 5G and the Internet of Things, to be able to feed real-time data to a dashboard, back-ended to an artificial intelligence somewhere. It is expected to generate millions, if not billions, from subscriptions and services to supplement its flailing hardware business. In the first 9 months of 2017, Fitbit device shipments fell 37% year over year. But for now, Fitbit will focus on rolling out the twin platform to its consumers, which will provide them with more context around their fitness data trackers. But the purchase could also lay the groundwork for future collaborations between Fitbit and healthcare networks that want to use Twine's health data software to support and measure valuable health metrics collected from the Fitbit trackers. Yeah, how about call Jeff Bezos? The fitness tracker company isn't alone in its move to healthcare. Apple has also made some aggressive moves recently with its Apple Watch and health apps as it strives to carve out its share of the healthcare marketplace. So, all right, now the next one, nanorobots shown to reduce and kill cancerous tumors. Well, hold on a second here because I wanted to find the Fitbit story. A couple people brought this to my attention that I have not covered it yet, and I had it queued up a couple times, and then it got lost in the fray. We're going to cover it now that Fitbit has come up in the conversation. We've talked about Fitbits before, Fitbits being one of the first pieces of the Internet of Things that is connecting our biodata to the cloud. Well, this is just an illustration of where this is leading us in our smart communities, in our smart future. This is out of Vox, Vox.com, February 1st, 2018. How a fitness application revealed military secrets and a new reality of data collection. So if you didn't think it was invasive before, put on a seatbelt because these are going to become mandatory in our future. And I will predict that with pretty high accuracy. Strava, which is a company that makes an application, Strava's global heat map shows that anyone with a Fitbit can inadvertently become a pawn in an uncharted world of collective data. Most of the 22 million people who reportedly use Fitbits and other fitness trackers probably are not thinking about what their daily jog or morning walk to work might mean for international security. But a recent startling revelation about what people's fitness stats are revealing to the world is poised to change that, and maybe even to permanently alter our relationship to data privacy. Guys, do not feed the machine. Over the weekend, news broke that a fitness-centered social media application called Strava had quietly, inadvertently divulged the location of secret military bases around the world. Uh-oh. Via its recently updated global heat map. Anyone wearing a fitness tracker like a Fitbit with the Strava app installed can make their location data public through an application which allows it to be included in the company's global heat map. And as it turns out, when you put enough soldiers in one place and they exercise in the same location every day, the collective composite heat map can reveal things over time that no one was expecting. And guys, this is how they, and that would be they in the cloud, the people with the dashboards that have backdoors into all of these technologies, are looking at our behavioral data and then feeding it into algorithms to determine information about us. They're building a dossier by looking at things. So this was done accidentally, or maybe someone at Strava did it on purpose. I don't know, but this is quite a shocker. For example, here is Strava's generated heat map, and that is in this article, and I will link to it in the notes of this show, of soldiers using the application on either side of the Korean demilitarized zone, and that would be between North and South Korea, or maybe in the region at the border. And the location of the soldiers stationed in sensitive areas of the world isn't the type of information that any country's military would typically want to have readily available online for any curious onlooker to see, but that is exactly what happened when Strava put it online, and exactly why many technology researchers are now calling for a serious reevaluation of how we think about sharing our personal data. It is a development tied to concerns about privacy and data collection and aggregation that researchers have been raising for years, as well as on the show. But the revelation that individual data collection may have seemed harmless in isolation, but it could upend closely guarded government secrets is a wake-up call to many people who never considered what the larger ramifications of sharing the location data with applications like Strava could be. Or with any application for that matter, or who knows who's writing it or what they're doing with that information you're giving away for free. Soon to be selling for some sort of microchip on the blockchain. Strava was launched in 2008 by who? Oh, two Harvard graduates. Well, go figure. Who wanted to combine media sharing with advances in fitness data tracking. And this app also allows users to compare their stats against other users of Strava who worked out in the same location and has been written about swooningly in the past as a boon to athletes looking to challenge themselves while competing in a kind of real-life online role-playing game and social media group where your opponents are other athletes just like you and the game is your daily exercise routine. Strava made its first global heat map available to the public in 2015 and then updated it this past November, complete with boasts as to how it contained six times as much data as before, as well as stunning images of human-powered thermal energy. And even if you download the Strava months ago and used it once and then never opened it again, your fitness data may still be part of the 3 trillion GPS points that went into Strava's heat map update, called, and I like that use of that word, from the app's reported 27 million users. Because they clicked that button and they opted in when they installed that data way, way back when without reading the terms and conditions. And since making your location data public is something that you have to opt out of rather than opt into, the opting out is somewhat difficult at that, and it is possible that many Strava users might not have even known that their location data was being collected to begin with. Yeah, and that's how it goes. At first, Strava's heat map didn't garner much notice. It was just a nifty feature of the app that was fun to play around with, while the rest of the app did the heavy lifting and allowing people to connect with each other through fitness challenges and location-based leaderboards. But then a 20-year-old international security student named Nathan Russer realized that 3 trillion data points used to build the heat map were so specific that they could reveal sensitive military information. Discussing his findings on Twitter, look out, Nathan Russer. He pointed out that the map reveals the apparent locations of secret military bases owned by the United States and other governments in places like Russia, Afghanistan, and Turkey, noticing that it seemed to pose an unprecedented security liability to soldiers. Yeah, and I wonder how many Turkish and Afghanistanian soldiers, though maybe United States ones, are wearing Fitbits. Anyone, it seems, could check out Strava's heat map and find clear images of locations that have been restricted by other satellite maps. And in fact, Strava's data map was so granular that people could then glean a significant details about such compounds going way beyond their general locations. And as The Guardian pointed out, zooming in on one of the larger bases clearly reveals its internal layout is mapped out by tracked jogging routes of numerous soldiers. Meanwhile, the Daily Beast speculated that because Strava tracks individual user data, the ability to tie an individual soldier's daily fitness routine to their location could aid and abet international military or spy tactics to previously unseen degrees. And think about that, like walking around inside of your house, they would have a data map of all your rooms and where you spent your time and where to more accurately target you. And this is just bad news, guys. And this is what the Internet of Things is going to do to our privacy. The rapid development of new and innovative information technologies enhances the quality of our lives. Oh, sure, it does, wink. But it also poses potential challenges to operational security and force protection. as well as your personal privacy. Strava made it clear both in its initial announcement about the heat map update in November and later in a statement released to CNN that the app, quote, excludes activities that have been marked as private and user-defined privacy zones. It also published a blog post urging users to double-check the privacy settings, and after a full day had passed, issued a follow-up blog post in which it explicitly took responsibility for the way it used the data you share with us. Strava further emphasized that its post that it was committed to working with military and government officials to address potentially sensitive data, who now are aware of the fact that Strava can track everybody anywhere. So they probably cut them a deal. So while Strava's response and the push for action from international coalitions might suggest there is no need to panic, well, the entire scenario highlights a very huge problem with the current state of data collection, one that some technology researchers have been debating for years. And the basic concept of data privacy is built around the assumption that it is possible to consent to the way that data is being used. Like they are saying with the blockchain, you'll be able to turn things on or off and control it all, but I don't believe that. And the Strava case makes it clear that such an assumption might be outdated, as it is fueled by a belief that many believe that data privacy is fear that individuals can't consent to use cases of their data if they don't yet know about it. To generate its heat map, Strata uses every piece of location data that has ever been shared with it. Just like the blockchain will be able to hold everything that's ever happened in the quote-unquote immutable database by every user who would have ever downloaded the app and ever consented to its privacy policies and its data collection. And because the data was already being stored and compiled by the app, the map itself cost only a few $100s to produce. Think about that for a moment. Most of us probably don't remember what apps we had on our phones a decade ago or even 5 years ago. And if you downloaded Strava when it launched in 2008 and never really got into it, today you may not even remember that you were ever a part of its user base. And what is more, most of us probably aren't even considering whether we think, sure, share my location data, that 10 years out, the location data might be used in totally unexpected ways. But that is exactly what happened with Strava. In a 2015 article by a team of data privacy researchers, explained the problem succinctly. Quote, once released to the public, data cannot be taken back, and as time passes, data analytic techniques improve and additional data sets become public that can then reveal information about the original data. It is followed that releasing that data will get increasingly vulnerable to re-identification unless methods with provable privacy properties are used for the data release. In other words, if you agreed to share data in 2008, could be increasingly repurposed and repackaged for uses that you could have never foreseen in 2018. Like when everyone signed up for YouTube and their Gmail accounts and fed everything and all your contacts and all your emails into the machine. Oh yeah, all that's bagged and tagged now and forever held somewhere in a cloud database for collating. As a tech writer and academic, Zeynep Tukefeki spelled out on Twitter, the Strava incident is a perfect case study for the implications of such unknowable outcomes, as it highlights a major flaw in thinking about what our data, our smartphone, and our wearable applications are collecting on an individual level. He also blasted the deflection of Strava's response by declaring check your privacy settings, which is what your Silicon Valley response is, and that is no response at all. In the digital age of data, data privacy cannot simply be negotiated and consented to at the individual level. By the same token, the Strava case should not be viewed as a problem for Strava. This particular app's data collection method and use case scenarios is no more or less ominous than those of any other app out there. And regardless of the purpose in the original scope, it is perfectly innocent reasons that this app would want to collect your data on an individual level, at least for now. And it is essentially impossible to predict what the data might reveal once you line it up alongside similar data from millions of other users or how that information might wind up being used against you many years in the future. So think about that one for a minute. So now we're going to get to a story we hit on Wednesday. Maybe I can, I don't know, I got another 10 stories lined up in about another 10 or 15 minutes. Closer to the edge, brain-inspired technologies will bring data processing and analytics to the Internet of Things devices. And they'll be devices that run applications like Strava. All right. So we have a forward-looking call to action for the microelectronics industry to create radically new digital communications architectures for the Internet of Things, in which a great deal of analytics processing occurs at the edge and at the end devices instead of being in the cloud. That is because once it is in the cloud, that connection has to remain high speed and always on for them to get the intelligence out of the data they are collecting. But making the Internet of Things possible with a new breed of memristors, we read about this as well, January 10th, 2018. Easily printable organic thin films can retain data for more than 10 years without power, work with low voltages, and become the building blocks of future computers that mimic the human brain. The Internet of Things is coming. That much we know, but what we still don't is that we don't know if we'll have components or chips that can handle the explosion of data that comes with the Internet of Things. And in 2020, by the time we have this 5G rollout deadline, there will already be 50 billion, with a B, industrial Internet of Things sensors all around us. And a single autonomous device, that be a smartwatch, a Fitbit, a cleaning robot, or a driverless car, that can produce gigabytes of data in just one day, where an Airbus may have over 10,000 sensors in just one wing alone. Two hurdles need to be overcome. First, current transistors and computer chips must be miniaturized to the size of only a few nanometers. And the problem is that they won't work anymore when they are that tiny, at least with current technology. Second, analyzing and storing unprecedented amounts of data will require equally huge amounts of energy. But don't worry about it, because we figured out we can use DNA to store huge amounts of data in a very tiny amount of space. Munjumudar and her colleagues from Aalto University have designed and fabricated the basic building blocks of future components in what are called neuromorphic computers, inspired by the human brain, and is a field of research in which the largest companies in the world and also in the EU are investing heavily. Still, no one has come up with nanoscale hardware architecture that could be scaled to an industrial manufacturing size and use, but the technology and the design of neuromorphic computing is advancing very rapidly, and it might rival a revolution in quantum computing. There's also already wide speculation, both in academia and company R&D, about ways to inscribe heavy computing capabilities in the hardware of smartphones, tablets and laptops, and of course the Internet of Things. And the key is to achieve the extreme energy efficiency of a biological brain and mimic the way the neurons network process information together through electrical impulses. Now, what's very interesting about that is we had already looked at artificial neurons that can compute faster than the human brain, and they can do it at very low power. Superconducting computer chips modeled after neurons can process information faster and more efficiently than the human brain. This achievement, which was described in the Science Advances of January 26, 2018, is a key benchmark in the development of advanced computing devices designed to mimic biological systems. Ding, ding, ding. And it could open the door to more natural machine learning software, although many hurdles remain before it can be used commercially. Artificial intelligence software has increasingly begun to imitate the brain, and algorithms such as Google's automatic image classification and language learning programs use networks of artificial neurons to perform complex tasks. But because conventional computer hardware was not designed to run like brain algorithms, these machine learning tasks require orders of magnitude of more computing power than the brain. So there must be a better way to do this, says Michael Schneider, U.S. physicist at NIST in Boulder, Colorado. NIST is one of a handful of groups trying to develop neuromorphic hardware that mimics the human brain in the hopes that it will run brain-like software more efficiently. And the conventional electronic systems, transistors processing information at regular intervals and in precise amounts, either zeros or ones, but neuromorphic devices can accumulate small amounts of information from multiple inputs and then alter it to produce a different type of signal and then fire a burst of electricity only when needed, just like biological neurons. And as a result, neuromorphic devices require less energy to run. And even though these devices are still inefficient, especially when they transmit information across the gap or the synapse between transistors. So Schneider's team created a neuron-like electrode out of something called niobium superconductors, which conduct electricity without resistance, and they filled the gap between these superconductors with thousands of nanoclusters of magnetic manganese. By varying the amount of magnetic field in the synapse, the nanoclusters can then be aligned to point in different directions, and this allows the system to encode information in both the level of electricity and the direction of the magnetism, granting it a far greater computational power than any other neuromorphic system without taking up additional physical space. These synapses, and we read about this last week, can fire up to a billion, with a B, times per second, which are several orders of magnitude faster than human neurons, and use 1/10,000th of the amount of energy used by a biological synapse. So way lower powered than a biological system, and a billion times per second, which is much faster. We're done, people. In computer simulations, the synthetic neurons could collate input from up to 9 sources before passing it on to the next electrode, but millions of synapses would be necessary before a system based on this technology could be used for complex computing. And I thought we read about that on Wednesday, that they were able to put billions of these into a cubic centimeter to build these circuits. So let's take it one step further. So where we started this little rant, brain-inspired technologies will bring data processing and analytics to the Internet of Things devices. Ding-a-ling-a-ling. Because I think this is the technology that they are talking about here. Emerging technologies such as advanced CMOS, 3D technologies, emerging resistive memories, and silicon photonics, coupled with novel brain-inspired paradigms like spike coding and spike time dependent plasticity, have an extraordinary potential to provide intelligent features in hardware approaching the way knowledge is created and processed in the human brain. Brain-inspired technologies towards chips that think included key summaries of research findings in a variety of fields that will play a role in developing brain-inspired technologies for computing and data handling requirements of our future hyper-connected world. We'll take one more step. So it's very low powered, but still maybe we might need some power every couple years. And these networks that are bagging, tagging, collating, and drawing intelligence out of the analytics and the sensors that are gathering data might need some juice. Well, there's a brand new gadget out of my alma mater, the University of Buffalo, February 9th, 2018, your gadget's next power supply, your body. We knew this was coming. Gold tabs attached to the skin convert mechanical energy into juice for wearables and self-powered electronics. Searching for a power outlet may soon become a thing of the past. Instead, devices will receive electricity from small metallic tabs that, when attached to the body, is capable of generating electricity from the bending of a finger or other simple movements. Searching for a power outlet may not be something you'll have to do, and that is the idea behind a collaborative research project led by the University of Buffalo and the Institute of Semiconductors at the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And the TAB, which is a triboelectric neurogenerator, has been described in a study published online January 31st, 2018, in the journal Nano Energy. No one likes to be tethered to a power outlet or lugging around a portable charger, and the human body is an abundant source of energy. We thought, why not harness this to produce our own power, says lead author. So triboelectric charging occurs when a certain material becomes electrically charged after coming into contact with a different material. And most every day, static electricity is triboelectric. Researchers have proposed numerous nanogenerators that utilize triboelectric effects. However, most are difficult to manufacture and are not cost-effective. A tab that the UB and the CAS system are developing addresses both of these concerns, and they consist of two thin layers of gold with a polydimethylsiliconane called PDMS sandwiched in between them. And the key to the device is that one layer of gold is stretched, causing it to crumple upon release and create what looks like a miniature mountain range. But when that force is reapplied, for example, from a finger bending, the motion leads to friction between the gold layers and the PDMS. This causes electrons to flow back and forth between the gold layers, and the more friction, the greater the amount of power is produced. So you could use it jogging with your Fitbit. And the study describes a small tab, which is about 1.5 centimeters long and 1 centimeter wide, and it delivers a maximum voltage of 124 volts, which is a maximum current of 10 microamps and a maximum power density of 0.22 milliwatts per square centimeter. That is not enough to quickly charge a smartphone. However, it will light 48 red LED lights simultaneously, like in your bunker. The co-author of the study includes a couple different people, and because the tab is easily fabricated, they are leading a team of UB undergraduates, which have been tasked with improving the tab's performance. The team plans to use larger pieces of gold, which, when stretched and folded together, are expected to deliver even more electricity. Researchers are also working to develop a portable battery to store energy produced by the tab, and then envision the system as serving as a power source for various wearables and self-powered devices. And I was thinking about that. You could get a battery bank and self-power your house, Johnny. You better get up off that couch and stop being a couch potato if you want the internet on in the future. All right, so where do we go from here? I don't know. I have a bunch of different stories. Amazing computer chip is made of live brain cells, and this is out of March 17, 2016. Researchers a few years ago in Germany and Japan were able to simulate 1% of the brain's activity for a single second. It took the processing power of the world's most powerful supercomputer to make that happen. But now let's move fast forward. Hands down, the human brain is by far the most powerful, energy-efficient computer ever created. And now we have made artificial neurons that can process things billions of times a second. So what if we could harness the brain's power by using actual brain cells to power the next generation of computers? Well, that sounds crazy, but that is exactly what neuroscientist Osha Kibidi is doing, and that's his startup. He's developed a prototype 64-neuron silicon chip, and this happens to be the one that can sniff, and we gave it sense of smell in Africa. He's using it to find explosives.
Question everything.